The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of The Heretics Hour. It's actually 2 hours with me, your host, Carolyn Yeager, on this Monday, February 18th, 2013. You know, the sound level always starts slow. I don't know. And then it picks up. So when I first say good evening, I sound like I'm far away, but here it's going now. All right. Tonight, my subject is the two lesser known of the major treaties that came out of World War I, the Treaty of Saint-Germain and the Treaty of Trianon. Now, I have more listeners than I thought I would have, because I don't think that there's a lot of people that are real excited about this. People aren't too interested in hearing lectures on history, and then they may think that they know all about this already, although probably they don't, and that they don't need to know anymore. But the reason that I am doing this program tonight is that someone emailed me a while ago asking me to look into Trianon, saying that what was done to Hungary was the worst of all the terrible things that happened in Europe between the wars. And not ever having any real clarity of details about this period, I thought I'd like to spend some time getting it clear for myself. So I did, and that's why you're going to hear tonight what I learned, because I have only so much time, and I prepare for my programs, and if I want to do something other than that, then that's going to have to become a program. That's kind of the way it is. So that's how we got to this tonight. And, it's a very confusing period and very confusing actors and players. I mean, a lot of them they're hard to exactly place. So, I probably haven't got the final word on it here, but I've got it, organized, in a lot better fashion than I ever was able to understand it before. So I will say that, just to give a little preparation here, the Empire of Austria-Hungary was a great power at the time, and it included a mix of different nationalities. It was truly a multinational society there, although it wasn't multiracial, unless you consider the Slavs a different race from the, the non-Slavs, or the Germans and Hungarians are not Slavs. So, there's that. And the Habsburg royal family really tried to keep all their people happy, all their various different groups of people, and be fair to everyone. And for the most part, they succeeded. And they were a royal family, and they wanted to continue, they all do. And so they did work hard at it. They weren't lazy people. They weren't bad intentioned people, but the times just, worked, and the kind of currents, that political currents worked against them. So, starting out, I've started out right with the treaties, but now I'm going to, I went back, and we need to start now with a brief introduction of how the war got started. You know, it wasn't German militarism. It was an assassination, which just about everybody's familiar with, the assassination on 28th June 1914 of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria. He was the heir to the throne of Austria-Hungary. You know, Austria-Hungary was one empire, but there was a king of Hungary and an emperor of Austria. That's how it was set up. And the overall emperor of the whole thing was the emperor of Austria, Franz Joseph. And I think Franz Ferdinand was his son. You know, I never quite got that clear. If it wasn't his son, it was some close relative, but he was the heir apparent to the throne. And I'm sure it was his son, but I'm not exactly sure. Okay. He was assassinated actually by a Slav nationalist when he was in Sarajevo, which was the capital city of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which were a part of the empire at the time, but not the most happy part of the empire. So this was the trigger for the war. Now, to go a little bit into this background of this, even though Bosnia and Herzegovina was still part of the Ottoman Empire, this is back before, you know, in the early 1900s, at least formally, but the Austrian-Hungarian authorities had factual control over the country. I guess that they actually ran it, because the Ottoman Empire had been so weakened, it was still, you know, considered to exist, but it didn't have any power. So Austria-Hungary was waiting for a chance to incorporate Bosnia and Herzegovina formally, as well as factually. So I don't know why they'd want to, because these are people are a lot of trouble, as they found, you know, as it turned out. And on October 5th, 1908, the Emperor Franz Joseph did announce the annexation. And I'm not going to go into what happened there. It's too confusing even for me to. I'm just looking at this actually right before the show. He announced the annexation of Bosnia and Herzegovina, and he ordered the Minister of Finance to make a new constitution for Bosnia and Herzegovina. And the annexation was accepted by most, but it caused unrest amongst the Muslim and Serbian population. The Serbs were very nationalist, and they had their own country, the Kingdom of Serbia, but they were also a lot of Serbs in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And they're just, you know, the way the Serbs have always been. So this nationalist, they call him a Yugoslavian. Well, Yugoslavia didn't even exist then. He was a Slav nationalist who murdered, the one who killed Archduke Ferdinand was actually a Jew. So you can say he wasn't a Serb. He was a Jew, if Jews are not really people of the national population, but in, you know, infiltrators and aliens. But as the thing to remember is that the person that triggered all this with his assassination of this, man who was going to become the future emperor of Austria-Hungary, not just anybody, was a Jew. So Emperor Franz Joseph, the way this happened was that Franz Joseph, the emperor, ordered the Archduke Ferdinand, who was his heir presumptive, to attend military exercises scheduled for Bosnia in the summer of 1914. So this was in June 1914. On June 28th, he toured Sarajevo with his wife, Sophie. And they were a young couple, quite a nice couple, you know, weren't threatening at all to anyone. Six armed, but you know, they were in an open carriage like, and I don't know if it was open, but the windows were open, but they were in this procession kind of, and they tell people that they're going to be there so that the people will come out on the sides of the street and greet them and, you know, their subjects and so on. It was all supposed to be a nice political event, because this was a newly annexed part of their empire. And these six armed irredentist Serbs, and irredentists are people who are unhappy under the rulership that they consider to be a foreign rulership. And these Serbs were not happy to be now under the Austria-Hungarian rulership. So these six armed men were coordinated by someone named Danilo Ilić. And they laid in wait, and they threw a bomb. And a bomb hit the motorcade as it approached the bridge. And 20 people were wounded, but Franz Ferdinand was unhurt. The bomb thrower had been instructed in Belgrade. Now, that's the capital of Serbia. So they were from Serbia, these Serbs. They weren't from, they weren't from Bosnia-Herzegovina. at least according to where this person was from. And he was supposed to take a potassium cyanide if he, you know, so he wouldn't be captured. And he did swallow it, but it didn't kill him. It just sickened him. And he was arrested and brought to the police station. And he was being investigated. And while the investigation was going on, another Serb called, whose name was Gavrilo Princip, shot and killed Franz Ferdinand and Sophie. They had from the bombing, and they were unhurt, they had decided to go on to the hospital to visit all the victims of the bombing, because see, they were trying to be good, you know, good rulers of their people and so on, and this would be the right thing to do, and this is the way they were. So they're innocently going, continuing on their way to the hospital, and this Princip managed to shoot and kill them. So he then took his cyanide capsule, but it didn't work on him either. So these Serbs couldn't even make cyanide capsules that worked. But anyway, within 45 minutes of the shooting, he was at this police station too, and he was telling his story to the investigating judge. So being that this was a totally unacceptable and shocking event for the Habsburg royal family and their nation, they had to do something about it. Well, first they had a big funeral and time of mourning and all of that, and it's kind of sad when you watch it on videos and that they had to deal with this. And then they didn't go and attack Serbia or start a war. They tried to figure out what to do, and Franz Joseph finally came up with a list of an ultimatum, he called it, a list of things that that he said that Serbia demands upon Serbia, because they had decided in their investigation that the Serbian government was behind all this. Well, others thought that there wasn't real proof that the Serbian government was behind it, but it was circumstantial, but it wasn't really proven. And, you know, there were, of course, nations that were more on Serbia's side because they didn't want to be on the side of the Austria-Hungary and Germany. And then there are those, and Germany was, of course, trying to be supportive of Austria-Hungary. And this is how, you know, this thing was going along, and everybody was kind of taking sides. But Austria-Hungary had to do something, and they sent this list of demands to the Serbian government. And the Serbian government, what it was they demanded, they had a list of demands, mainly demanding that Serbia publicly condemn the, quote, dangerous propaganda against Austria-Hungary that had been going on for quite some time, the ultimate aim of which, they said, is to detach from the monarchy territories belonging to us. That is to stir up and agitate anti-monarchy feeling among these people in the southern Slavic parts of the empire to want to separate from Austria-Hungary. You know, in my opinion, you know, they should let them go, but then they just have a trouble on their border too that they wouldn't have any control over, and they didn't want to anyway, because they needed, in order for that nation, that empire to continue, it needed to be pretty big, and have all the resources that it had by being as large as it was. So Belgrade, though, they said that this was criminal and terrorist propaganda that was coming out of Belgrade and all that area, and it needed to be suppressed. Well, Serbia refused, and they were said they were insulted by this, and they couldn't do it, and then there was lots of talk about it. But finally they said that they would accept it because they were being pressured to do so, except for point six, which asked that the Austrian police be allowed to operate in Serbia. And they said there's no way they could allow that to happen. The Austrian Austrian police thought they needed to be there to find these people who were starting these problems, and because the Serbians wouldn't do it. So this became difficult. And as I said, all this wheeling and dealing was going on. And even Churchill, who was, head of the Admiralty, I had that title of his, but now I've forgotten it. He stated, the Austrian ultimatum to Serbia being the most insolent document of its kind ever devised. That wasn't helpful. So you know what side he was on. He was certainly not trying to be helpful to the Austrians, or the Germans, you know, German Austria. So, he said that, but then he said he believed Britain would stay out of the war. He was assuming there would be a war, but Britain would stay out of it. Yeah, that really is so typical of this Churchill. He was always a warmonger, and he was always getting others in war for Britain's interests and trying to keep Britain out of it if he could. Several alliances were formed over the previous decades, you know, between these countries, and these were invoked. And so, it's, you know, in the end, within weeks after this, the major powers were at war via their colonies, and conflicts soon spread around the world. And I don't know that you don't find, at least I couldn't find in the time I had, information about just what Jewish influence was there, because they were pretty much in the background at this time, and there's a lot of other problems going on which could be responsible for it all, which was this Slavic nationalism, but we do know that the person who did do the killing was a Jew, so we know that the Jews were involved in all that to the extent that they could be. So then we had World War I, and we all know what a terrible thing that was and how much misery that caused. And Woodrow Wilson got the United States involved at the end, towards the end, the last year, 1917. And just a little note here, he used the phrase, the war to end wars. This was the World War. This war was the Great War, was the war to end wars. But that's attributed to him a lot. But actually, it came from Aldous Huxley in one of his books, where he was saying that there would be a great war, and it would be the war to end wars, because there wouldn't be any more war after that. And war would be obsolete and things like that. You know, he was a futurist. And Wilson only said that, used that phrase once, but he did say a few times that that he wanted the United States to enter this war to make the world safe for democracy. This is what he used with the Americans, and he said that in the joint session of Congress when he asked them to declare war against the Central Powers. They needed to enter to make the world safe for democracy. All right, so we finished with the war, and now we're in the closing days of World War I. And some background on this for the Austro-Hungarian Empire. A socialist count, Mihály Károlyi, in October 31st, 1918, the war was still going on, had established the Social Democratic Hungarian National Council in the Kingdom of Hungary, that part of the empire, which demanded the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So this was some Hungarians who, at the end of World War I, when there was so much agitation going on by Jews and Bolsheviks and various other factions, wanted to separate from, wanted to have an independent, totally independent Hungary. Even though the Austrian-Hungarian Empire was supposedly, you know, they were equal parts of it. And Hungary was quite large at that time, the territory. And he had, with the support of the soldiers from the Hungarian army, they wore aster flowers, and it was called the Aster Revolution. They seized public buildings throughout Budapest, and Prime Minister Sandor Weckerle resigned. That's a German name. He resigned, and former Prime Minister István Tisza was murdered. It was actually a coup d'etat called the Aster Revolution. By the end of the day, King Charles IV of Austria, because, Austria had its king, Charles, had accepted the coup and appointed Károlyi as Hungary's new prime minister. You know, I find this a little confusing, but what I have to think is that the Austrian part, you know, Austro-Hungarian Empire was actually two different nations, Austria and Hungary. And Austria had this King Charles, and Hungary had their own king too. But together they were the empire, and that was headed by the Habsburgs, Franz Joseph, and whoever. Nobody became his heir because the empire ended before, you know, he was still alive. So that's partly why this gets a little confusing. But this Hungarian Democratic Republic was proclaimed on 16th November 1918, just as the war was coming to an end, with Károlyi named as president. So they went from a kingdom in Hungary to a democratic republic. Everything was anti-monarchy at that time. But in the meantime, the armistice of Via Giusti, which ended warfare between Italy and Austria-Hungary, this is part of World War I, on the Italian front, on 3rd November 1918, that armistice was signed, sealing the fate of the Austrian-Hungarian monarchy. On the 11th of November 1918, Emperor Charles I of Austria officially declared that he relinquished every participation in the administration. That is, he stepped down as, now they're calling him emperor, instead of king of Austria. And one day later, the Provisional Assembly declared German Austria a democratic republic and part of the German Republic. So both of these parts of Austria-Hungary had separated, and now they were declaring each one separately to be a democratic republic. German Austria was what they called themselves. German Austria, German-Austria, they were calling themselves, claimed sovereignty over all the majority German territory of the former Habsburg realm, which was a total area of 45,500 square miles with 10 million inhabitants. And this included nearly all the territory of the present day Austria, plus other German speaking areas, which included South Tyrol, which is now Italy's, and the town of Tarvisio, both Italy, Southern Carinthia, one of the most southernmost parts of Austria today, and Southern Styria, Sudetenland, and German Bohemia. We were talking about Bohemia earlier. This was a large area. At the time, the majority of inhabitants in these regions were German-speaking. And what was the German Republic? The Republic that emerged from the German Revolution. So now we're up in Germany, okay? The German Revolution of November 1918, the German Revolutionary period lasted from November 1918 until the formal establishment of the Weimar Republic in August 1919. So when it said that German Austria declared itself part of the German Republic, it means what we would consider Germany proper, that is, Austria wanted to formally join with Germany as German-speaking and culturally German people. And, of course, it is known, it is a fact, that Austria had always wanted to be, the German Austria had always wanted to be a part of Germany, or at least for a long time, I better not say things I don't know for sure. All right, so going back to Austria now, at the time that Charles I stepped down, things were falling apart in this Austrian half of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Because the new, there were some parts of it were separating themselves and claiming themselves states. And I guess with the help of the Allies, because a lot of things were going on here, but the newly established states of Czechoslovakia, Poland, and the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes had been proclaimed. I don't know who proclaimed them exactly, but they had been proclaimed, and they had support in that. So Austria was losing large parts by people just saying, you know, in all of this turmoil, people just saying, well, we're leaving this this empire. We don't want to be a part of it anymore. And South Tyrol and Trentino, which were always a part of Austria, was now occupied by Italian forces. And also, it was the Slav troops entered the former Duchy of Carinthia in South Austria, which I mentioned, leading to violent fights. That's where Willie Christman's family was from, where he was born and grew up. And he was telling us in earlier shows about the violence that was going on there. That was the Carinthia was always one of the most nationalist-minded provinces in Austria, south down there. Well, they always had this battle with the Slovenians there. There were a lot of Slovenians, so that caused the German nationalism to be more striking. Anyway, they held some plebiscites in the provinces of Tyrol. That's the one that's bordering with Italy, and in Salzburg, and they yielded majorities of 98 and 99% in favor of a unification with Germany. On November 22nd, On November 22nd, the National Assembly officially laid claim to all German area, ethnic German areas. This would be the National Assembly of Austria, of this new, Austria that was struggling to keep going there and keep its size. So they laid claim to these ethnic German areas, the ones that I described above, but the allies of the war, France, Great Britain, U.S., and Italy too, opposed such a move, and German Austria was largely powerless to resist the forces of all these people and of Italy. This new Czechoslovakia, this new Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, from seizing territory. They just didn't have any way to prevent it. No power. So an Austrian Constitutional Assembly election was held on 16th February 1919. So now we're in 1919. The war is over, all this rearrangement is going on. The assembly reelected Karl Renner as state chancellor for the Austrians and enacted the Habsburg law concerning the banishment of the House of Lorraine, that is the Habsburg royal family. So they convened and they rejected the royal house of Habsburg. There was no longer a monarchy, and that was the end of the monarchy in any form or shape in Austria. And so then in March of 1919, we go back to Hungary. The Hungarian Democratic Republic that I told you about was overturned by another revolution, and the Hungarian Soviet Republic was created. Yeah, so this had a short life, but it was followed by the restoration of the Kingdom of Hungary, but as an independent nation. So we have German Austria, and we have the Kingdom of Hungary as two independent nations. But they had to have these treaties, see, because the Allies were going to carry out all their punishments for these countries, which were their enemies during the war. So this was yet to happen. When Chancellor Austrian Chancellor Renner arrived at Saint-Germain in May 1919. He and the Austrian delegation found themselves excluded from the negotiations led by French Prime Minister Georges Clemenceau. Under an Allied ultimatum, Renner was forced to sign the treaty on September 10th. That was the first one. And then the Treaty of Trianon with Hungary was signed in June 1920. And it completed the disposition of the former dual monarchy. Then Germany, of course, was forced to sign the Treaty of Versailles on June 28, 1920. Most people are quite familiar with the Versailles Treaty, and we hear a lot about it, but the other two are not so well known, and I certainly didn't know enough about them, not much at all. So now I'm going to talk about these two, starting with the Treaty of Saint-Germain-en-Laye. Well, that was where it took place, in a wealthy suburb near Paris, Saint-Germain-en-Laye. There are other Saint-Germains, but this one is the one in Paris. Near Paris, and with Austria. And it was signed on 10th September 1919 by the victorious Allies and Republic, what was now considered the Republic of German Austria. Who were the Allies? Again, France, Great Britain, Russia, Italy, and the United States. But at the table, it was Clemenceau for France, Lloyd George for Great Britain, and Wilson for the United States. The others weren't there. Well, Russia, of course, wouldn't have been, because Russia dropped out of the war in October 1917, and because of their Bolshevik Revolution. And Italy had come in a little late in 1915. You know, Italy is always taking advantage of the... I'm sorry to be, you know, saying things about nations and people of our white race, but, you know, they're always looking for the best opportunity. They're not the most dependable allies. They were on the side with the Central Powers, and then they switched over because they saw that looked like the better deal. And they did gain from it, but not as much as some others did, but they did gain. A little bit about the Russian Bolshevik Revolution, why they ended their participation in the war. It was just called the Great War then. It was not called World War One. They stopped fighting mainly, really, because the Russian army was no longer a viable military force. It was poorly supplied, trained, and led, and it was no match for the modern German army. So the only reason that they were effective was because the Central Powers in Germany had to fight on two fronts, you know, that deal again. And that made it difficult, even though Germany could have easily beaten Russia itself, because Russia was not in good shape. It was suffering great losses. Soldiers were deserting. Well, if you've read any of Solzhenitsyn's books about that war, man, I mean, the officers and the generals and everything were just horrible. They're just horrible. They were just sending these Russians out there to be slaughtered. They had, they had terrible strategy. They didn't seem to care. It was just a mess there. And so these soldiers knew, and they were fed up. They were tired of seeing them, you know, having such great losses and being just thrown into these battles with no hope. So they welcomed the Bolshevik Revolution, since it put Vladimir Lenin in a position to end the war, which he said he was going to do. And he did. And he signed a treaty, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, whatever I pronounce that, with Germany. And they signed that treaty, and that ended the war on the Eastern Front, which was, made Germany happy. But it still other machinations were taking place, which caused Germany to agree to a surrender when it should never have done so. But anyway, back to the treaty now. Let's just focus on the Saint-Germain Treaty. The provisions were that, one, that the Austro-Hungarian Empire was to be dissolved. It had already dissolved, but this was, you know, the formal signing. You know, it was done for, could not be resurrected. And the Austrian side naturally accepted responsibility for causing the war, along with the other Central Powers. So this was in all the treaties. They had to accept full responsibility for causing the war, which they didn't do, which is why I went into how the war started, because it wasn't started by anything that the Austrians, Hungarians did, or certainly not anything the Germans did. They were kind of forced into it. And this is one little lesson we should take that that makes you think that there's a Jewish mind behind was the Jewish mind behind all this, because they set things up, or somebody does if it's not them, set things up to lead us step by step into consequences that we don't want and would never choose. But, you know, one thing leads to another. You do what you have to do, often out of honor, you know, for honorable reasons and to save face and so on. You can't just let people, you know, come and kill your heir apparent to the throne and things like that and not do anything about it. So they were trying to find a way to save face, to save their honor, the Austria-Hungary, and still, especially Franz Joseph, and still, you know, not bring about a war or anything like that, but it wasn't possible. So, you know, lots of people were involved in seeing that a big war took place. But they had to take the responsibility. So then the treaty recognized the independence of Hungary from Austria. See, this is what Austria had to sign. They had to, you know, accept that Hungary was independent. Czechoslovakia existed and had the land, the territory that it had. Poland had the territory that it was given, and it was independent. And the kingdom of the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes now had their territory, and they were independent. And it included war reparations of large sums of money directed towards the Allies to pay for the cost of the war over a period of 30 years. It was going to last for 30 years before they got it all paid off. Now, but the worst was the territorial losses. Austria faced significant losses. I've actually already gone through them. They lost Bohemia and Moravia, which were part of the empire, and that formed the core of this newly created state of Czechoslovakia. I don't know if I already said it, but, you know, the Czechs never had their own state before this. They existed and they considered themselves a nation. And I might be wrong about this. They might be able to point to something here or there somewhere. But in modern time, anyway, they were a part of the other states, and they were part of Austro-Hungarian Empire. There was a large, after the Germans and the Hungarians, the Czechs were the largest nationality in that empire. But now they had been wanting it, and now they got their own nation, their own state and territory to rule over. And it was a pretty good size one, too. Pretty good size. They got stuff from Austria and some stuff from Hungary. And Austrian Silesia was split between Czech Silesia and Polish Silesia, so that went to those two countries. The large German-speaking population in German Bohemia, which was really Germany, went to Czechoslovakia, and the Sudetenland was taken away, and that was Czechoslovakia. Yes, I believe. And that was a pretty good sized country. And Galicia and Lodomeria, they had been annexed by the Habsburg monarchy in 1772. They fell back to become a part of the reestablished Polish Republic. Now, Poland was whatever it was before this, you know, they had had their own state, but I think they didn't. And now they also got, the Polish Republic was reestablished and they got some new territory and so on. And the adjacent, Bukovina, went to Romania. That had been a part of the empire. And the Tyrolean, crown land, you know, Tyrol up to the Brenner Pass, which included predominantly German speaking, South Tyrol and the, and this, Trentino province. Well, together with the Carinthian canal valley, went to Italy and some other parts there, that they mention here, some islands and stuff like that went to Italy. And, the main part of the former kingdom of Dalmatia and Carniola and Lower Styria, with the Carinthian Mesa Valley, blah, blah, was ceded to the, they keep calling it the Yugoslav Kingdom. I guess that word was in use, of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, but the official name of it was the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. Then there was the Burgenland, which, had been part of Hungary, was given to Austria. The only thing Austria gained after all it lost was this little area called the Burgenland, because it was mostly German-speaking. And in southern Carinthia, which with its Slovene-speaking share of the population, it was the only one that was allowed to be decided in a plebiscite. And in that Carinthian plebiscite, they voted to stay with Austria and not go into the, I guess, the kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. So Carinthia stayed with Austria. Now, in politics and military, what this treaty meant was that Austria could not enter into political or economic union with the German Reich. Without the agreement of the Council of the League of Nations, which didn't give their agreement. Now, Austria at that time had wanted to. They were trying to join the German Reich because they were so small now. Austria was called the Rump. It was really a tiny country now, and they didn't have the resources. All of their, you know, all of that part that was taken away from them had all these various types of resources that they needed to be a, you know, an independent state. And there, now they had none of that. You know, it's just pure punishment by the allied powers of these countries. That's all it was. And, hoping that they would just suffer and fail and so on. The, and their name, they had the name that they chose for themselves, German-Austria, was, well, they couldn't keep it. It had to be changed to just Austria. So they wanted to prevent, of course, any union of Germans, and they didn't want Germany to get any stronger. They, of course, weakened Germany terribly in the Versailles, with the Versailles Treaty. So the same thing here. So Austria was condemned to stay by itself. And this was something Austrians knew was really, really, they really couldn't do well that way, but there was not, they had no choice. Austria's later economic weakness was caused by the loss of all this land, and Austria did become a very weak country for a while economically, and the people were not doing very well there. Lots of unemployment, and they also didn't allow conscription in Austria or any of these nations, and their army was limited to 30,000 volunteers. How big of an army is 30,000? Not very big. Plus, they lost their connection to the sea, and they had to deal with numerous provisions to use the Danube navigation and the transfer of railways because it was always running into somebody else's country, and you know that was difficult. And then, of course, their population was vastly reduced along with their territory and the resources, as I mentioned. So. The All right. Then the Austria created a peace, signed a peace treaty with the United States. The United States was not at, it was at the peace treaty, but Woodrow Wilson signed it, but the Senate didn't sign it. The Senate would not sign it because of some reason, because it did not ratify the, a peace treaty between the U.S. and Austrian governments signed in Vienna on August 24th, 1921, because the U.S. Senate did not ratify the multilateral peace treaty signed in Saint-Germain. Okay, the United States Senate wouldn't ratify that treaty. Because it was under the auspices of the League of Nations, and they had not joined the League of Nations, and it was the Senate that was against it, even though Woodrow Wilson wanted the U.S. to join it, but they never did. They never were, because the Senate wouldn't ratify it. So, the U.S. government had a separate treaty with, Austria, and, they had to pay money to the U.S. government too. The U.S. government was in that war for 1 year, but they had assisted, the other allies quite a bit, just like they did in World War II with, you know, material and money and so on. So they wanted to get all paid back for that. So they had this treaty where Austria had to pay them money also. They did try to do something helpful in keeping the people from forming alliance. Well, that's it. You know, they did this. Oh, I know. They embarked on a path of partially assisting the government of the Austrian Republic to ease the burden of war reparations. But I believe they did this with the aim of keeping Austria independent of Germany. They didn't want Austria to totally collapse. And then the people would really be, you know, rebelling. The main thing behind all these great powers, these allied powers, was to keep Germany weak, and they had to keep these other countries from forming any alliances with Germany. So now we're going to go to the Treaty of Trianon, which took place at Versailles in France, the same place that the Treaty of Versailles was, but in a different building, in the Trianon. With Hungary, we had gotten to the place, when we were talking about Hungary, where in March 1919, the Hungarian Democratic Republic was overturned by a second revolution, and the Hungarian Soviet Republic was created. It had a short life, as I said, followed by the restoration of the Kingdom of Hungary, but as an independent nation. It was the successor of the Hungarian Democratic Republic, the original one, and lasted only from 21st of March until 1st of August 1919. And it was, well, now we're talking about the Hungarian Soviet Republic, led by Béla Kun, and was not recognized by France, the United Kingdom, or the United States. The Treaty of Trianon had not been signed yet. They still had this Soviet government there. It was the first communist government to be formed in Europe after the October Revolution in Russia, before that one in Bavaria. It came to power as the only group with an organized fighting force, promising Hungary would be able to defend its territory without conscription. We're not going to draft any of you people, but we've got a lot of fighters. And they promised that there would be military help from the Soviet Red Army against Romanian, Czechoslovak, and Yugoslav forces, none of whom were communist at that time. Hungary felt, again, well, you're going to find out how much was taken away from Hungary, even worse than Austria. Very much worse than Austria, although, I don't know, Austria was left with as little bitty nothing. But, you know, Hungary had been quite large, and now it was going to get much, much smaller. And so the people were concerned about these neighbors that now were independent and might attack them and so on. And, And this Bela Kun, you know, was promising things that actually he couldn't deliver. But this was called the Hungarian Republic of Councils. And it had, there did exist some military conflicts with the Kingdom of Romania and the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, who are kind of troublemakers, and the evolving Czechoslovakia. It collapsed when actually the Romanian forces occupied Budapest after the Kingdom of Hungary was reestablished. Well, you know, the forces, the anti-communist forces were still there. And they finally got together with, there was a kind of a revolt, you know, the people joined in. And then the Romanian military came in and occupied Budapest, which was the capital of Hungary, and reestablished the Kingdom of Hungary. Well, it happened after that. So Bela Kun fled to, at that time, along with other high-ranking communists, fled to Austria. And that was on August 1st, 1919, with only a... let's see. There was a minority, including Lukács, the former commissar for culture and noted Marxist philosopher, remaining in Hungary to organize an underground communist party. Okay. Just a minority of these communists remained there. The rest of them fled, and because they felt that they were the ones that were targeted. And this commissar of culture remained with a few others, and the Budapest Workers' Soviet elected a new government headed by Gyula Pytel, which only lasted a few days before these Romanian forces came into Budapest on the 6th of August, and that put a final end to the Hungarian Soviet Republic. Then Horthy comes in. You know, Horthy was there in World War II also. Semi-regular detachments, technically under Horthy's command, but mostly independent, initiated a campaign of violence against communists, leftists, and Jews, known as the White Terror. So if the White Terror then started taking place, which to me would be a good thing, and they're trying to clean up their country and put it back in the hands of the good Hungarians and not these communists, leftists, and Jews. There are a lot of Jews. At one point, I'm going to come up to this, but 5% of the Hungarian population was Jewish. 5%, that's quite a bit. Of course, it was more in Poland, but that's still quite a bit. Many supporters of the Hungarian Soviet Republic were executed without trial after this white terror. And others were imprisoned by trial. So most of them were later released to the Soviet Union by amnesty during the reign of Horthy after a prisoner exchange agreement between Hungary and the Russian Soviet government in 1921. In all, about 415 prisoners were released as a result of this agreement. So they didn't all die. Kun, Bela Kun was one of them who was sent to this Soviet Republic is in this exchange, the Soviet Union, I mean, and an unknown number of other Hungarian communists. And they, though, he was one of the ones who was also executed during the Great Purge of the late 1930s. So, you know, serves them right. So they were doing all this communist work, but Stalin didn't like them. Found something wrong with them, and they got executed in the 1930s. Boy, that Soviet Russia was such a place of you couldn't trust for your life from one day to the next. I couldn't have stood to live in that kind of an atmosphere. Now the provisions of I've only got a few minutes left in this first hour, ladies and gentlemen, and then once again we have the new music for this show, which is Frank Reneke singing Heldengedenken, which is translates basically as remembering heroes, which is very nice. So That's coming right up. But for now, I'll just start listing the provisions of the Treaty of Trianon against the Hungarians by the Allies. Compared to the pre-war Kingdom of Hungary, which is part of the Austria-Hungary, of course. Post-Trianon Hungary had 72% less territory. The area was 93,000 square miles and square kilometers, 35,000, almost 36,000 square miles. And the new population was 7.6 million, which was 64% less than the pre-war kingdom. So they lost 72% of their territory and 64% of their population. That's quite a lot. That's quite a shock. The pre-war kingdom of Hungary was 325,000 square kilometers. Didn't I already say that? No, I don't know. And okay, let me skip that. 31% of ethnic Hungarians now lived outside the newly defined borders of post-Trianon Hungary. So when that many ethnic Hungarians were now outside the borders of Hungary, 31%. It also lost 5 of the 10 most populous cities of its pre-war kingdom. And it also, like Austria, did not have direct access to the sea. And this is a real problem for any country. So we're coming right up here. I will continue with this when we get back. I want to thank you all for being here tonight, and I'll see you in 5 minutes.
Im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn, was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die, heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Musik. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt. Was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit und welche Erbärmlichkeit.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager on Monday, February 18th, 2013. My topic has been the treaties of Saint-Germain and Trianon, and I'm now started discussing the Treaty of Trianon between the Kingdom of Hungary and the Allied victors of World War One. And I was giving the provisions of the treaty, and I had just said that, you know, they lost 5 of the 10 most popular cities because their area, the territory of their nation had been reduced by they had 72% less territory than they had before. So you can see that they lost a lot of population, and they lost 5 populous cities, and they did not have direct access to the sea. Now, continuing with that, they also had a restriction on their army, their military, and they could only have 35,000. That's 5,000 more than the Austrians could have. And their navy had ceased to exist because, of course, they didn't even have access to the sea now. The principal beneficiaries of this treaty were Romania, Czechoslovakia, a new nation, and the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, another new nation. The territories that were assigned to these countries were mainly populated by ethnic Romanians, Slovaks, and South Slavs. Hungary had to pay war reparations to its neighbors, they had to pay in animals and grains and things like that too, cows and sheep and calves and so on to some of these neighbor people and some of these countries, new countries around them too. Doesn't that just grab as much as they can possibly get out of people? The Hungarian delegation signed this treaty under protest on 4th of June, 1920. And then that was, after that came the Versailles Treaty on June 28th. I think it was 1920. So, and this was at the Grand Trianon Palace in Versailles, France. In 1938 to 1940, during World War II, post-Trianon Hungary temporarily expanded its territory and included some additional territories that were formerly part of the pre-war Kingdom of Hungary under the Third Reich auspices. It was later reduced to the boundaries of approximately the same ones they had here now, you know, in 1920. After this treaty, it's like they're back to where they were. They got a little bit additional territory, with the help of the Third Reich, and they were, again, aligned with Germany in World War II, but then it was taken away again during the peace treaties after World War II. So now we're going to go into here exactly what Hungary lost. On the 1st of December 1919, the Hungarian delegation was officially invited to the Versailles Peace Conference. However, the newly defined borders of Hungary were nearly finalized already without the presence of the Hungarians. You know, they had already done all that before the Hungarians got there, before they were even, you know, told to come there. And during the prior negotiations, the Hungarian party, along with the Austrian, that is the delegates who went, the representatives from the country, from the nation that went to the peace conference, advocated the American principle of self-determination. They were promoting self-determination according to the Wilsonian, ideal that had been presented, both the Hungarians and the Austrians. For the Austrians, German speaking, and for the Hungarians, the Hungarian speaking people. And they said that the population of these disputed territories should be decided by free plebiscite, so the people could determine who they wanted to belong to. And this was, again, according to these policies that they were promoting, that they said they stood for democracy and you know the right of the people to determine their own wishes what they wanted to be and who they wanted to belong to. But this was ignored by the decisive French and British delegates. Let me remind you, ladies and gentlemen, that you can call in during this hour at 1-830-443-4911. That's 1-830-443-4911. I did look at my email. I didn't see anything there. According to some opinions, the Allies drafted the outline of the new frontiers with little or no regard to the historical, cultural, ethnic, geographic, economic, and strategic aspects of the region. The Allies had assigned territories that were mostly populated by non-Hungarian ethnicities to successor states, but also allowed these states to absorb sizable territories that were mainly inhabited by Hungarian-speaking population. For instance, Romania gained all of Transylvania, which was home to 2,800,000 Romanians, but also contained a significant minority of 1,600,000 Magyars, that is the Hungarians. So, of course, the problem that they had here was that while you could find, say, the majority of German-speaking or Hungarian-speaking people maybe in one area and, you know, say, well, this is the country, you had also large amounts of people spread around in different pockets and places pretty far from one another. So you had German-speaking people in outlying areas, and they were just stuck because they couldn't, you know, as long as it was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they were all part of this one empire. It worked better in that way. But now with all these small independent states, a lot of people were stuck in countries ruled by those who not only didn't speak their language and didn't have any particular liking for them, but even were hostile to them. And this was something that I could see it would be difficult unless you transport people. But that's not good because people have land or they have some property or they've got, you know, employment where they are. They've got family and relatives. They've been there for a long time. You don't just up and leave and go into a particularly these poor countries now. Hungary and Austria were both so much poorer and go there as refugees or something when nobody, you know, there's not enough for the people there. There's not anything for you. So this is what happens when they start messing around well, these human beings start messing around with deciding and redesigning nations and national borders like they seem to love to do in the 20th century, and probably they're still doing, and to suit their own political preferences. So the intent, because the intent of the Allies was to weaken Hungary, just as it was to weaken Germany. The Hungarian delegates tried to draw attention to these issues, but their views were disregarded by the Allied representatives. So the final borders of Hungary also did not include the rest of Transylvania, which became part of Romania. You know, Transylvania was kind of a, as we said, it was a mixed Romanian and Hungarian population, though it did have a majority of Romanians, but they were kind of separated, so you could have put one part with one and one part with the other. And that's what they wanted. They wanted the Hungarian part of Transylvania to be attached to Hungary, but they wouldn't do that. They gave the whole thing to Romania. And the reasoning behind this, we're going to find, is because, again, they wanted to weaken Hungary and they wanted to weaken Germany. If they weakened Hungary and Austria, then that in itself weakened Germany. And then they had all these other states which were larger now than these ones were, and around to buffer them, because they didn't have this kind of allegiance to Germany, for one thing, or to German-speaking people. So then along with Transylvania going to Romania, Carpathia and Ruthenia went to Czechoslovakia, and the Burgenland, which I'd mentioned before, went to Austria. The district of Sopron, S-O-P-R-O-N, was the only one able to have a plebiscite. Again, they had one plebiscite, and they opted to remain within Hungary. That was held in December 1921. It was the only place where I already said that. So the Austrians got one plebiscite and the Hungarians got one plebiscite, and that's all. There's another place called Medemurge and a place called Slovene Marsh, and another place. No, that's another name of it. These became part of the kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. That was taken away from Hungary, too. And then there were some cities that were under the Serb, Croat, Slovene administration that were assigned to Hungary. There was an arbitration committee in 19... there were some small northern parts, little counties, little things, you know. These went to, that had a Polish majority in the north, and these went to Poland. Then after, as I already said, after 1918, Hungary didn't have access to the sea, which they had previously. So, according to the 1910 census, speakers of the Hungarian language included approximately 48% of the entire population of the kingdom. This is now, remember, this is in 1910. So this is before all this happened, before the assassination, before the war. You had speakers of the Hungarian language in 48% of the entire population of the Kingdom of Hungary in 54% of the population of the territory referred to as Hungary proper, excluding Croatia, Slavonia, that is those southern Slavs there. Within Hungary proper, this is where it says there 5% of the population were Jews. But they were included as speakers of the Hungarian language. They weren't marked out as separate, because they did this census according to what language you spoke. That's how they did it. And there were, within the borders of Hungary in 1910, There were Romanians, or 16% of the population was Romanians. They would have been said that they were Romanian speakers. 10% Slovaks, 10% Germans, and 2.5% Serbs, 2.5% Ruthenians. So you see, this is the way it was in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And you had all these people, these pockets of people. Now where do they go? That, you know, you can't put people just with their own same speaking population very well. But in the cases where people can vote, if they're side by side, you know, if they're touching in the areas that they are, but they took those people away too. So the population of the autonomous Croatia, Slavonia was mostly composed of Croats and Serbs. So they were okay. That wasn't too much of a problem. Now, I've got here that the Allies rejected the idea of plebiscites. This was a real wrong thing that you can point to them for, you know, after all the fancy talk that they give. They rejected the idea of plebiscites in these disputed areas. As I said, with the exception of the city of Sopron in Hungary, which voted to remain with Hungary. They're indifferent to the as to the exact line of the newly defined borders between Austria and Hungary also. Furthermore, ethnically diverse Transylvania was ethnically diverse, but they treated it as a single entity and assigned it entirely to Romania. Things like this are bitter taste, leaves a bitter taste in your mouth. And, of course, all in all, the Western powers or the Allied powers' main priority was to prevent a resurgence of the German Reich. And they therefore decided that her allies in the region, Austria and Hungary, should be contained by a ring of states friendly to the Allies, each of which would be bigger than either Austria or Hungary. And Romania, Poland, and Czechoslovakia were all made bigger. These countries, Romania, Poland, and Czechoslovakia, were all bigger than Austria or Hungary when this was all over. And also these new countries were friendly to the Allied countries that gave them all this, you know, and they remained good relations, particularly, say, with France and some with Britain and maybe some even with Russia. But Romania and Poland had ties. Romania and Czechoslovakia had ties with France, and Poland had a kind of an agreement with. They had ties with France, too. But they had kind of an agreement with Great Britain, too, to come to their aid. So they were, this was all set up to keep the German Reich down. And again, with Hungary, same as with Austria, it lost connection to strategic, military, and economic infrastructure because of the concentric layout of the railway and road network, which the borders bisected. See, there were so many borders now that it kind of interfered with their infrastructure. The Western powers were aware of the problems posed by the presence of so many Hungarians and Germans living outside the new nation states of Hungary and Austria. They knew that this posed a problem because these people were unhappy. There was a secret pact between the Entente and Romania in the Treaty of Bucharest. I don't know how this fits in, but there was a Treaty of Bucharest in 1916 Romania was promised Transylvania at that time and the territories to the east of the river Tisa, provided that she attacked Austria-Hungary from the southeast. Now, the Entente in Romania, that was the Allied powers. the Allied powers had, this was, oh, well, yeah, the war was going on, 1916, okay, sorry. And they promised Transylvania to Romania then if she would attack Austria-Hungary from the southeast, where the defenses were weak. However, the Central Powers had noticed the military maneuver. They noticed that she was setting up to do that, and the attempt was quickly choked off, and Bucharest fell in the same year, Bucharest, Romania. So Romania didn't succeed in that at all, didn't accomplish it, but they still got the Transylvania. And the it says the French sided with their allies, the Romanians, who had a long policy of cultural ties to France. Well, as I was saying, this is like in World War II, where France had cultural ties with some of these key countries that were stirring up trouble and really were the cause of war breaking out. Now, this part is interesting, I think. Most Hungarians regarded the treaty as an insult to the nation's honor. The Hungarians had a lot of spirit. They're pretty tough people. And they were really, I think the Austrians took it better. The Austrians took it more, you know, as resignedly. Well, there's nothing they could do. And they realize there's nothing they can do. And they try to make the best of it. But the Hungarians were really angry. And their political attitude was summed up in the phrases, nem, nem, soha, no, no, never, and mindent visa, return everything, or everything back. They just didn't accept it, you know, and they were saying, this is no good, never, never, give it back. And the perceived humiliation of the treaty became a dominant theme in the interwar Hungarian politics, analogous with the German reaction to the Treaty of Versailles. The outcome of the Treaty of Trianon is to this day remembered in Hungary as the Trianon trauma. All official flags in Hungary were lowered until 1938, when they were raised by one-third after southern Slovakia, with an 84% Hungarian population, was recovered following the Munich Conference and Vienna Awards. That is, when in 1938, when Hungary got something back because of the National Socialists and the Hitler regime of what they had lost, they raised their flag back up by one-third. But they had kept their official flags lowered all that time, it says. I think that's cool. And they, well, there's just more little detail here. Okay, economics. Now, some more about the Kingdom of Hungary. It was the main supplier of wheat, rye, barley, and other various goods in the empire and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Obviously, lots of agricultural land there. And these comprised a large portion of the empire's exports. Meanwhile, the territory of present-day Czech Republic, the Kingdom of Bohemia, used to be, owned 75% of the whole industrial capacity of formal Austria-Hungary. So Hungary was, you know, strong in agriculture, or at least grains, and what was given to the Czechs, the Kingdom of, you know, the Bohemia, was 75% of the whole industrial capacity of the former Austria-Hungary. So this shows that the various parts of the formal monarchy were economically interdependent. As a further illustration of this issue, post-Trianon Hungary produced 500% more agricultural goods than it needed for itself. So it couldn't export them that well. So it says that the mills around Budapest, some of the largest ones in Europe at the time, operated at 20% level. They were only operating at 20% because, as a consequence of the treaty, all the competitive industries of the former empire were compelled to close doors as great capacity was met by negligible demand. You know, they had all this capacity, but now there wasn't. There wasn't the demand, owing to economic barriers presented in the form of the newly defined borders. Well, of course, everybody was poorer. There was unemployment. There was, you know, it was not, there was no prosperity going on. So it showed that what these allied powers had done was totally wrong and unsuccessful, but yet they went around crowing about themselves and continued to act like, you know, they are wonderful people. Their arrogant unconcern for real people in real life and their desire to secure political control, this is what I'm saying here, screwed up Central Europe really good. Today, the U.S. United States is doing the very same thing. The U.S. has always enabled this, and it is totally Jew-controlled, too. So, you know, the U.S. is driving itself and all parts of it down the drain, and it's under the control of the Jews. So the Jews must have had a lot to do with all of this, you know, World War One. We can't see them there as easily as we can see them in World War II, but they had to be there. And Henry Ford, in his book, The International Jew, it is presented there that the Jews were all over these peace conferences. They talk about the Paris Peace Conference. Well, that was all of them, all three of these, Versailles, Germany, Austria, and Hungary. All these treaties were around the same time in Paris. And they said the Jews were everywhere running everything. So, you know, they had prepared for this. They knew the war was coming. I have talked in some of these, international Jew programs, Hadding and I, about how they were influential in the United States preparedness committees and all that movement where people were clamoring for the United States for Wilson to prepare us to enter the war, and he didn't want to because he was still thinking he wouldn't enter the war, but things happened which caused him to suddenly change his mind, seemingly suddenly, because I think he sincerely didn't want to, but he became convinced. And all these movements had all kinds of Jews involved in them and behind them, you know, saying, oh, we need to prepare to go over to Europe and fight, you know, it's going to come. And of course it did. So, and then they knew what they wanted to get out of the peace conferences too, way ahead of time. They were all prepared for that. So, you know, going back to the person who did the first, started the whole thing with that assassination of the, Franz Ferdinand and his wife being a Jew, it's always these Jews. It's always these Jews. Now, here, we have the unemployment in Hungary. The unemployment levels in Austria as well as in Hungary were dangerously high, and industrial output dropped by 65%. That's pretty terrible. What happened to Austrian industry happened to Hungary in agriculture, where production of grain declined by more than 70%. And again, Wilhelm Christman told us about this, how bad the unemployment was, and he was just a kid growing up, and he didn't, you know, he didn't feel the effects as badly, but everybody was poor, but you know, when you're a kid, you don't really notice that so much. But his father was a school teacher and a principal, so he continued to have work for that reason. But they were nationalists, and they always looked to Germany that was what they wanted to be aligned with Germany and wanted to be joined with Germany. So it says to go on with this unemployment in Austria, especially in the imperial capital of Vienna, was a leading investor of development projects throughout the empire with more than 2.2 billion crown capital That was in his good days. This sum sunk to a mere 8.6 million from 2.2 billion to 8.6 million after the treaty took effect and resulted in a starving of capital in other regions of the former empire. I wish I could give more background on what, how this happened and what, you know, how this takes in the Jews. Of course, Vienna was has always had a lot of Jews. Vienna is, of course, they go to the large cities. But Vienna, Austria was always infected with way too many Jews. That's where Hitler, when he went to Vienna, that's when he first noticed Jews and first became aware and what we'd call Jew aware. It was in Vienna. So going on, this, the disintegration of the multinational state. And this might sound a little strange to us because, as I said, Austria-Hungary was a multinational state. And for that reason, Hitler did not like it. He hated it. He liked Germany. And eventually he moved from Vienna to Munich. And shortly after that, though, maybe a year or two, don't have those dates clear right now either. But sometime after that, you know, the war broke out, and then he joined, and everything changed after that. But he was disgusted with Austria-Hungary because of the multiculturalism and said nothing could get done, you know. It was just a whole lot of arguing and bickering all the time. But according to his idea of how things should happen, and lots of things get done, you know, It wasn't as bad as what happened after the war, you know, with these, you know, it was going along better for the people than it was after the war and after these treaties. But anyway, so here they kind of, you know, you have to fit this into the where I'm getting this information. It says the disintegration of the multinational state conversely impacted neighboring countries too, in Poland, Romania, Yugoslavia, and Bulgaria. A fifth to a third of the rural population could find no work, and industry was in no position to absorb them. So these countries who had gotten this territory and, you know, gotten what they wanted, they were not doing well either. Not at all. Nobody was. Of course, you know, then we went into these, but the Depression didn't come until 2930. So this was still from 1920 on. Things were not doing well. I guess, you know, in France and Great Britain and United States, they were having booms. They didn't care, but these people were not. 5 years after the treaty, the traffic of goods between the countries dropped to less than 5% of its former value. Less than 5%, 5 years after. So there was no comeback. There was no rebound. The whole thing didn't work. And this could be attributed, it says here, to the introduction of aggressive nationalistic policies by local political leaders. Well, these nations were also jealous now of what they had, you know, their own little piece of land there or big piece of land. And they were in control. You know, they ran the government and they couldn't cooperate with their neighbors. This is not the fault of nationalism. It is a fault of this type of situation that was created in this part of the world, by the Allied powers, these stupid victors of World War I, and the Jews behind the scenes all the time. So, you know, but it's not, to me, it's not a denunciation of nationalism, but they want to make it out to be, you know, they want to say, well, this is what happens when you have nationalism. Well, it isn't, but it happened here because these people were angry with one another. They were either envious or jealous or fearful of one another, and they didn't want to give way in any way. We know that, say, the Czechs in their Czechoslovakia, they didn't run that country right at all. They just favored themselves and disfavored their minorities, and they just, you know, never did the right thing, and they the whole country suffered for it because they were so supercilious about being in charge and taking away and being giving as much as possible for the Czech people, and not anything for the other for the Germans and the other minorities that were there in their country, trapped in their country, not wanting to be there, but there they were. It said that the treaty, in the provisions of the treaty, it required Hungary to recognize the rights of national minorities within its borders. Well, okay, but, you know, they were all supposed to do that. They were all supposed to do that, all these countries and these new countries, but they didn't do it. And the trouble with these things is that they set up all these laws and formalities and so on and treaties with provisions and so on. You have to do this, you have to do that. But then nobody enforces it, except for the ones, for the losers who are having to pay either in money or in goods, reparations. But other than that, they're not enforcing that these other people do the right thing. And also in this, Treaty of Trianon, the Article 61 to 66 stated, that all former citizens of the Kingdom of Hungary living outside the newly defined frontiers, living outside of the new boundaries of the new Hungary, were ipso facto to lose their Hungarian nationality in 1 year. So they didn't want them, you know, they didn't have a right to come back after 1 year if they didn't already return there somehow. They couldn't do it anymore. I mean, they weren't considered Hungarian nationals anymore. That's kind of a, oh, I don't know what to say about that. Again, if anybody wants to call in, has anything to say or to add or to correct me on, the number is 830-443-4911. I've got a little bit more. I can't actually manage to get through the rest of the show, but it's not the most important stuff. But this is kind of interesting here, is the talking about the League of Nations. And the League of Nations was, they say that it was founded as a result of the Paris Peace Conference. It's called an intergovernmental organization, founded as a result of the Paris Peace Conference. But it was actually underway before that, and in the idea stage long before that. It wasn't a result, you know. They didn't say at the Paris Peace Conference, well, we need to have this organization, but they did probably maybe finalize it then. Let's see. It says, when the First World War was still underway, or while it was still underway, a number of governments and groups had already started developing plans to change. Now, you know that the Jews were in on this big time. They had already started developing plans to change the way international relations were carried out. Woodrow Wilson and his advisor, Colonel Edward M. Howes, who so many consider to be an agent of the Jews in there, and he had Wilson wrapped around his finger. This Wilson. So Wilson and Howes enthusiastically promoted the idea with Wilson's 14 points for peace. And the final point in his points for peace stated, a general association of nations must be formed under specific covenants for the purpose of affording mutual guarantees of political independence and territorial integrity to great and small states alike. And for this, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1919. That peace prize comes out in September, October. So, you know, the war ended, what, November 1918 or something? And the following year, this idiot got the Nobel Peace Prize. Well, you know, already then, it was politically motivated. It was no good. When has that Peace Prize ever meant anything? It's always been under the, it's always been run as a political tool. That's what it is. Of the one-worlders, of the globalists. You know, that's what it is. It was the first international organization, it says, whose principal mission was to maintain world peace. But I don't know where that was ever stated. I don't think it was stated in the covenants of the League of Nations. What they did state was that the primary goals included preventing wars through collective security and disarmament. Well, that hasn't happened. They haven't managed to, they never managed to disarm people. They couldn't this was in 1920. Now, how did World War II happen if any of this was working? And, another of their goals was settling international disputes through negotiation and arbitration. Well, they didn't succeed at that. Other issues in this and related treaties included labor conditions. Well, I don't know if they have helped. They may have had some influence in labor conditions in the Third World, because most anything that was actually accomplished was to improve the Third World or to bring Third World people into First World countries. And another of their goals was just treatment of native inhabitants. Because look at the Palestinians. Were they assuring just treatment of these people? That's just one example. Look at World War II. I mean, you just can't, you know, there's no, they weren't able to do any good there. And then another thing they were supposed to, they have in their, covenant is, to stop human and drug trafficking. Well, human and drug trafficking is worse than ever. And it's mainly run by the Jews. So there you are. That's really the problem, why none of this stuff gets accomplished. The arms trade. They were going to stop the arms trade or improve it. Well, it's worse than ever. It's got to be worse than ever. They were going to do something about global health. Well, the only thing that's done about global health that I can see is to vaccinate everybody, is to this big vaccine industry, which is another thing that's actually bad for everyone. So this is another one of these scams, and that hurts people. You know, that takes away people's health rather than improving their health. Then they were going to affect prisoners of war, make that situation better. Well, look at Eisenhower's DEF, disarmed enemy forces, and what he did to them. So did they say a word about that? Well, they were out of existence by then, right? But they didn't do, they probably made some effort there, but none of it took hold. And protection of minorities in Europe. Well, it seems to me that the only minorities in Europe that they protect are non-white ones. That's what they had in mind. They had in mind to protect the non-whites. The League of Nations had 58 members at its largest, when it was most popular. Its greatest number was 58 from 28 September 1934 to 23 February 1935. So less than 1 year, it was doing its best then in the 30s. It was very unsuccessful. So, that's about what I have there. Let me check this. And I have another story here that I thought I might like to, just keep talking. Oh, here's an email from Frederick Tobin in Australia. He says, Carolyn, I am sitting here listening to your most informative history lecture. I'm sure he could give a much better one. It's fascinating for me because I do not know too much about this. Makes current issues so transparent. Thanks, Frederick. Well, isn't he a darling for saying that? He's learning something, he says. He says he does not know too much about it. Well, I thought that if I didn't know too much about it, probably some other people didn't either. I hope I gave, that's all I have on that, and I hope I gave I gave it clearly enough, and that it helped some of you get a better understanding. All right, I've lost a few listeners, but that's okay. They figure the show's over now. But I do have, you know, there's something that came up today. It is about the Holocaust. Just before the show, I opened an email from a friend in England, And she sent this story in one of the newspapers there. It's Helga. There's a new book out called Helga's Diary, a young girl's account of life in a concentration camp. And it's, you know, as she says, it's just another, this, a play on, Diary of Anne Frank. And, they call it A Child's Account of Life in a World War II Concentration Camp. Has been released almost 70 years after it was written. Okay, well, supposedly she wrote this diary 70 years ago and just now released it. Isn't that amazing? And at the time, she was 8 years old, and she started keeping her diary in 1938. Well, this person that wrote to me about this said that she didn't believe it at all. She thought it was just a big made-up story, like there are more and more of these, or there always have been, but they keep coming out with them to keep the interest up and to keep people believing in the Holocaust and all these terrible things that happened to these innocent people. So in this one, I'll just tell you about it. This is a girl named Helga Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, German. She's got a German first name, a German last name. So, but she's Jewish, you know, and her story echoes that of Anne Frank, the Jewish girl who kept a journal of the 2 years she and her family hid from the Nazis in secret rooms in Amsterdam, blah, blah, blah. It's published by Viking, and it documents the Nazi invasion of Prague and life for the city's 45,000 Jews. Oh, they were living in Prague, a beautiful, beautiful German city that the Czechs were able to take over. And they keep it up nicely, though. And at this time, there were 45,000 Jews living in Prague. And she tells how her father was denied work, and she was not allowed to keep going to school, and her parents were confined to their flat. I really can't say. I was conversing with a German who lived at that time and is very pro-Jewish and pro-Semitic and has a blog. This is Herb Stoltman in his blog. And, you know, he says a lot of things and posts a lot of things on there that are not true, but he just accepts them. And this sounds like, you know, something else. I mean, one would have to research into what was going on in Prague. If you can find out the truth and how actually these people were treated there, to find out, you know, how close to the mark she is here. But in general, it is true that Prague was Germany at the time. You know, I mean, the Germans had taken over Czechoslovakia, Bohemia, Moravia, and it was back in German hands. So some of this stuff they did not allow. I did just read today that Jews were not allowed under the Nuremberg laws. The Jews were not allowed to continue in public school after past age 14. And then if they wanted to continue schooling, they'd have to do it on their own in some private school. But the public school only, but they did go to public school until the age of 14. She was only 8 years old, so I don't know why she would say she couldn't go to school anymore, but depending on, I don't know. She says in 1941, they were sent to Theresien, that supposedly nicer camp in Austria, for special, artistic Jewish people, Jewish artists and scholars and, you know, people of a higher level. They didn't want to send them into a ordinary work camp, and they built this camp. It was very nice, but she, I guess, talks about it differently, but it was nice, and these people were able to do all kinds of artistic pursuits and theater and musical shows and so on. Even though they were not free to leave or anything, but it wasn't that bad. But she says, she said that she and her parents were there for 3 years and under harsh conditions, disease and suffering, she documents in her moving entries, as well as the friendships she forms. And they tell us she's still alive today. And in a 2011 interview, she said, and don't tell her age here, but you'd have to figure it out. She said, one thing after another was forbidden. Employees lost their jobs. We were banned from the parks, swimming pools, sports clubs. I was banned from going to school when I was 10. Well, I don't know. Some people say they were banned from going to school when they were 8, or maybe it was when they were 10. Anyway, this doesn't sound so terrible. I mean, they couldn't go to the park. They couldn't use the swimming pools. That's true. That was in the Nuremberg laws. They couldn't go to the sports clubs and then they had the schooling restriction. So she says, she was saved from the gas chamber, this says here. I was always asking my parents what's happening and became angry at them if I thought they were trying to hide something to protect me. My father told me that whatever happens, we must remain human so that we do not die like cattle. And I think that the will to create was an expression of the will to live and survive as human beings. Well, let's see. Were they artists? Is that why they went to Terezin? I don't know. But they said, it's funny that she uses the expression cattle, which is what the non-Jews are called, as with the expression, with the word goyim. And they don't want to die like goyim. They don't want to die like non-Jews. They hate non-Jews. They're so inferior to themselves. So they say we must remain human, which is what I think this is all made up, but I would interpret that as we must remain Jewish. We must remain Jewish and keep our Jewishness because this is what makes us human, human beings. So she says that in 1944, she was moved to Auschwitz and her entries in her diary ended. She left the diary with her uncle in Terezin, who bricked it into a wall for safekeeping. Oh, can you imagine? He put her diary in this wall and she returned after the war to collect it. Or he did, one or the other. And Helga and her mother, Irina, survived the whole ordeal, but her father, Otto, did not. He was never heard from again. Well, they were, I don't know. Yeah, I guess at Auschwitz they were separated. So Helga and Irina returned to Prague, and Helga completed her diary documenting life in Auschwitz. And the book reveals how Irina saved her daughter's life by convincing Josef Mengele, the so-called white angel, that Helga was older than she was and therefore able to work. Oh, there's that old story, you see. That's how she was saved from the gas chamber at Auschwitz because her mother convinced Josef Mengele that Helga was older. And they all say this for why these youngsters, who are supposed to have been gassed, you know, if you're under a certain age right away, why they weren't. And so she was moved to a labor barracks. Now, as soon as you bring up Josef Mengele, you know that they're making it up. He couldn't have been, he certainly wasn't deciding for every single person at Auschwitz-Birkenau whether they went to a gas chamber or not. And, of course, there weren't any gas chambers. So right there, by adding that, she destroys her credibility altogether. She also, I was going to say something else that destroyed it. Well, the fact that she's waited so long. She finished her diary, after the war. But why did she wait until now to show it? So it's, again, there's no answer to that, but they all say that. They all come out all these years later and tell these stories. Now, she says that she was one of 15, or they, the people writing this, say she was one of 15,000 children taken to Terezin and later moved to Auschwitz. Out of these 15,000, just 100 survived. Now, where is the documentation for that? There's nothing. There's nothing there. But this is, if this appeared maybe in the Telegraph, No, IBT Times. Let's see. I think she, I thought she said she saw it in the Telegraph, but, whoever, whatever newspaper this is being pushed in, they're saying this because they don't say Helga says or anything like that, that, you know, oh, 15,000 children taken in, 100 survived. You know why they do that? Because the majority of people are going to just believe it. They're never going to question. They're never going to say, well, how do they know that? Or, you know, where do we find out about this? They don't even want to find out. They just, there it is. It doesn't cost them anything either, because if nobody's going to question them, I mean, people that would question them, they don't have to answer. They're just Holocaust deniers. You know, they don't have any responsibility for what they write in the media. None whatsoever. Now I was talking about Jews earlier. Well, well, these are Jews, and these are Jews who are pushing this story too, and they brought out this book, that's for sure. And in 1954, Helga married musician Jiří Hosek and had 2 children and 3 grandchildren, and she still lives in the flat where she was born, so she's still in Prague. Lucky her! Lucky her! What about all those Germans who were living in Prague that got kicked out? I interviewed one of them, Professor Wesserle, several times. I got to bring his shows out again in my oldies but goodies. There's just so much. They were so good. And he told all that story. He lived close to Prague, and his father had worked in Prague. Well, I have reached the end of the program somehow. I just kept talking. So I managed to do it. This is an interesting story here, but it's another example. I want you to look for it. And it's another example of the kind of crap that they put out there, and people accept it. And this has to be taken down, all of this. And I think that the story of the treaties after the war also help us to see, get the big picture of how much dishonesty, how much deceit, how many lies are involved in everything concerning this. If we just look at some of the details, we see the hatefulness and the lack of concern for certain people, and the desire to destroy the way of life of white European people. And it's just all so obvious. So thank you very much for being with me today. This is Carolyn Yeager at the Heretics Hour. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.